Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. I'm joined once again by my friend and my colleague, Mark DiGirolami, the center's associate director, for another episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on our website, Law and Religion Forum, that's one word, lawandreligionforum.org, and also on Apple iTunes. Well, today, Mark, we're going to talk about a controversy involving a group which is called the Satanic Temple. And this is a group that's made some waves in law and religion matters recently. Earlier this year, the IRS granted the temple 501c3 status, which means it's now recognized as a religion, a tax-exempt religion for purposes of federal law. And then there have been a number of other controversies across the country in which the temple, which is now a religion, recognized religion, has insisted on the right to give invocations along with other religious groups at local legislative sessions, and temples also preparing to claim an exemption from a recent Indiana law involving the burial of fetal remains, so it's going to start claiming religious accommodations now. In itself, I think it's fair to say the temple is not very significant. It's a fringe group. The goals of the group, as we'll see, are essentially satirical and political in nature. It was founded only a few years ago, and I think it exists actually precisely to mock religion and to provoke a reaction. And so you might think, well, it's not really worth paying attention to this group. It's not a good idea to have our church and state law distorted by a fringe group like this whose whole point is to get a rise out of people. But I think, Mark, it's worth discussing the Satanic Temple because the group very cleverly exploits tensions in religion clause jurisprudence, especially the insistence on neutrality and equality that characterizes that jurisprudence. And so it's useful to reflect on those tensions and what the temple is trying to do and to ask whether neutrality and equality as hard commitments really can work in the religion context. So the way we'll handle this podcast is first we're going to do some background on the temple, and then we'll ask the question, is it a religion for legal purposes? And along the way, we'll talk about these broader issues in church-state law and what the controversy about the Satanic Temple reveals. Okay, so let's start out first with some background on the Satanic Temple. Mark, you want to start us off?
Sure. So the temple was founded in 2013 and describes itself as a non-theistic religious group. It's based in Salem, Massachusetts, home of the famous witch trials of Arthur Miller fame and otherwise. I think it's fair to say, as you had mentioned earlier, Mark, that the motivation for the temple or its commitments are essentially political commitments. The founders came up with the idea of the temple in order to mock the Bush administration's faith-based initiative.
Yeah, what was that initiative, Mark?
Well, that was something, and if you remember, so the Bush 2 years were 2000 to 2008, and during those years, the Bush administration made funds available to religious entities for charitable work. And so the Satanic Temple's at least initial aim was to participate as a quote-unquote faith-based group, basically in order to ridicule the program or to make a point about what it thinks is the injustice of the program.
Right. That was the first idea, although I guess it took a little while for them to get off the ground. They organized themselves a few years later. If you look at the website, you see they have vehement disagreement with the pre-existing Church of Satan, which was another group founded in the 1960s, which I guess doesn't reflect what they think is true Satanism. They think the Church of Satan is too hierarchical, which just goes to show that the odium theologicum exists here too, these groups fighting over what is really Satanism. If you go to the temple's website, they describe their tenets as promoting compassion and wisdom and reason and justice and so on. But I think it's fair to say there's not a lot of thought put into these. They seem frankly like a slogan and a screen for the real purposes of the group. And as far as I can tell, the real purpose is to protest, to object to the place of traditional religion, which they refer to as superstition, in American law and politics, and especially, as we'll talk about a little later, especially Christianity.
Okay, good. And so the other tenets that we can talk about, they don't believe in a supernatural Satan.
Right, because they're not theistic.
Right, and perhaps we actually didn't investigate this, but maybe that was a point of division with the Church of Satan that actually believes in Satan. But the temple does not. Satan is for them a kind of symbol, the symbol of the quote-unquote eternal rebel or the outsider.
It's all in Milton.
Right. Well, exactly. Except that Satan was an actual figure.
Right.
So the group uses satanic imagery to promote various secular progressive causes like egalitarianism, social justice, and of course the separation of church and state. And also, if probing further, they believe in a kind of naturalism, scientism, with the inviolability of the body as a key doctrine, and in consequence as a practical matter in the absolute righteousness of abortion. They believe in radical personal autonomy. They disbelieve in and think evil traditional forms of religious authority, in particular, of course, Christianity, which has been, at least as a historical matter, the dominant religion, traditional religion of the United States. And so they use Satan as a kind of emblem for all of these collection of beliefs.
Right, and in that sense, of course, they're parasitic on Christianity, which has Satan, which actually does believe in a real Satan as the fallen angel who embodies evil in a way. The temple also uses satire as well as direct legal action to promote its aims. And again, its aims, I think, are largely mocking traditional religion and especially church-state accommodations. For example, a few years ago, Oklahoma...
Mocking in protest.
Mocking in protest, right. When Oklahoma planned to erect a Ten Commandments monument on state capitol grounds, the temple immediately sued to have a Satanist statue, the Baphomet statue, installed as well.
Which is like a goat or something?
Like a goat's head, like a pagan idol sort of thing.
Right.
And then when Oklahoma dropped its plans for the Ten Commandments monument because of a state court decision, the temple dropped its suit as well. So it was really just a kind of a stunt. Didn't really want the statue there, I guess. The group likes to erect Satanist displays adjacent to Christmas holiday displays on state capitals and on public property. They've started a school prayer group called the After School Satan Club to counter evangelical Christian groups and so on. As we say, the special stated target of the Satanic Temple seems to be Christianity. The Satanists are very interested in dislodging Christianity from what they claim is its position of privilege in the United States. So that's sort of a run-through of the group's aims and goals. As we say, it's essentially, I think, a political organization and has essentially a negative and critical orientation.
Okay, good. So then the question arises, is the Satanic Temple a religion?
Yeah, and earlier this year, as I said, the IRS recognized the temple as, quote, a church or a convention or association of churches for purposes of a tax exemption under 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code.
Okay, and what's the payoff with respect to that issue, Mark? In other words, why does that matter?
Well, the payoff is now the IRS has given the Satanic Temple the same nonprofit status as other religious entities, like the Roman Catholic Church, which means that the temple is now exempt as a church from federal income tax, and also, it means that donations to the temple are tax deductible to individual taxpayers. And that's the federal rules. And now most states follow IRS determinations with respect to tax exempt status, which means that the Satanic Temple is also tax exempt as a church in most other states of the Union.
Now, there's some political developments, I guess, that drove the temple to seek to do this,
yes,
right?
Yes, so the temple had not sought tax exemption before, but they sought recognition as a church in response to recent moves to repeal the so-called Johnson Amendment. Now, the Johnson Amendment prohibits churches from endorsing political candidates or engaging in political activities. Recently, some evangelical Christians have tried to get the Johnson Amendment overturned. I think Mike Pence has said he would approve its being overturned.
We should mention also that one of our speakers at our colloquium, the last time that we did the colloquium in 2018, Philip Hamburger, has a very long and a very interesting book about 501c3, the history of 501c3, and specifically the issue of the Johnson Amendment and the restraints that it puts on religious organizations from advancing what he calls idealistic views.
Right. And so now that some churches are trying to get that amendment repealed, so now they say, well, okay, if the churches are going to be able to engage in politics, then we want to be able to engage in politics too. Since, I'm quoting now the leader of the temple, since the religious are now able to engage in politics and, quote, gain ground as a privileged class, The temple wanted that status as well. So again, you can see this highlights the kind of political nature of the temple's activities. Okay, so the IRS has said the temple is a church. So how does the IRS define church? The IRS doesn't have a categorical definition here. If you look at the IRS regulations, you'll see that there's a 14-factor test for whether something is a religion. They look to a number of factors, including whether the entity has a recognized creed, a recognized form of worship, whether there's a formal code of doctrine and discipline, whether the organization ordains ministers after the ministers have completed a course of study, whether it has established places of worship and regular religious services and schools and so on. So there are a number of factors here. When you look through these factors, I have to say, Mark, with respect to the majority of them, it's not clear to me that the temple really qualifies as a church. Yeah, I don't think it meets these tests.
It doesn't seem like for a lot of these things, perhaps we don't know enough about the temple. That's certainly a possibility. But just at least reading from the website and gathering the information that we have, it doesn't seem like it satisfies at least, I would say, at least half of these factors.
That's how it seems to me too, Mark. But the IRS is typically very lenient in saying what a church is. They're pretty lenient. They don't want to really get involved in tough decisions.
Well, that makes a certain amount of sense, I suppose.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Just like the rest of government, as we'll talk about.
As we'll talk about, right. Now, so that's the IRS determination. The IRS has determined that the temple is a church for purposes of the tax code. Now, we should say that that determination would not bind courts outside the context of the Internal Revenue Code, and probably it would get some deference within the statutory context, within the context of the code under Chevron. But we should say this is the IRS's determination. It doesn't bind the courts with respect to other sorts of questions. Okay. Now, one reason why the IRS is so lenient with respect to defining a church is that the Internal Revenue Code doesn't define church. And in fact, our courts really have not clearly defined religion generally for legal purposes, including First Amendment purposes. The courts have adopted different definitions of religion at different times in our history, in different contexts, and there's surprisingly little Supreme Court law on the subject.
Yeah, and one might wonder, before we get to the ways in which one could define religion, why it is that courts and the government in general has been so reluctant to get into this territory. And there are some worthwhile, some historically powerful reasons.
Absolutely.
Involving exactly the question of whether the government ought to have this kind of power over religion. Of course, in established states and countries with established religions, the government has a much stronger hand in making these distinctions. But even in states and countries where there is no established religion, I think of Italy, for example, as one, the government does tend to take a stronger hand in making determinations about which are the authorized, state-authorized religions, or which ones get certain sorts of treatment and which ones don't. In the United States, we really don't have that kind of tradition because of our strong Protestant separationist starting point.
Yes, well, at least separationism is a strong theme in America.
Correct.
Life the way it's not in others. Yeah, we'll talk about some of that. No, the government has been very reluctant to get involved in the definition of religion for some very good reasons. We'll talk about some of them. But before we talk about these themes, Mark, let's talk about some of the black letter law with respect to the definition of religion.
Okay, and you think you're right, as you said, that there's very little law on the subject. There is very, very little, perhaps no, we can talk about that, constitutional law on the subject. There have been different definitions at different times. If one thinks it just conceptually about the way that one could think about different ways of thinking about the substance of religion, it seems to me that you could come up with really three or four different ways of thinking mm-hmm. about it. A first way would be a substantive or objective definition. So you look to the traditional essence of religion, some sort of substance, perhaps belief in the supernatural being, mm-hmm. theistic, a group that takes on a corporate form, a group that has a certain body of traditions, teachings, or rituals, customs of worship, and so on. And I think that there are at least some Supreme Court decisions that, while they've never identified a substantive definition of religion as the definition of religion for constitutional purpose, they at least seem to assume something like that. One of those is the Yoder decision,
right,
involving whether the Amish community can get a particular exemption from Wisconsin law. And they the court really sort of focused on the longstanding quality of the Amish faith, their groupish quality, and other similar sorts of definitions. Another decision is Reynolds versus United States, the 19th century case involving bigamy and whether the Mormon religion was going to get an exemption from a particular criminal penalty for engaging in bigamy. And the court basically, again, without adopting a substantive definition, said, well, no, that's not religion, right?
Right.
You know, engaging in bigamy, that's not the kind of thing that we're going to countenance as being religious for constitutional purposes.
Right. So there are some themes in the case law that talk about religion as being a substantive thing involving, as you say, theism and corporate form and traditions and a community existing through time and worship and so on. But there are other cases which take a very different approach to this. So some cases talk about religion as a functional thing. And in deciding whether something is a religion, the court would say, well, does this thing, does the belief system, does it serve the function of a religion in the life of the claimant? Does it speak to the claimant's highest concern? Because that's the function of religion, one's highest concern. Doesn't have to be theistic on this definition. Maybe even deep philosophical convictions could be considered religion on this definition. The cases we're talking about here are the so-called draft cases from the 1960s. That's a very different approach. Not religion as a substantive thing, but religion as performing a certain function, and could be a variety of things that perform that function.
And again, two notes on that kind of view of religion. The first is, as you mentioned, Mark, this was the kind of definition that the court came up with for the Selective Service cases. That was motivated by the interpretation of the Selective Service statute. So the court really has never talked about a functionalist definition with respect to the constitutional meaning of religion. That's number one. And number two, you know, there have been, the court drew on some of the 1960s, 70s liberal Protestant theologians like Paul Tillich to come up with this quote-unquote matter of ultimate concern approach, which was, I mean, it sort of sounds like the disco 70s, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if it's really important to you and it makes you feel in a certain way, then it's religion.
Right. And so, again, not exactly neutral, just like Reynolds was not exactly neutral in the 19th century.
Of course not.
Then
yeah.
Sometimes courts have talked about an analogical approach. And so when examining whether something is a religion or not, the courts will say, well, does it look like something we would conventionally recognize as a religion? I mean, you know, that inevitably, in my mind, blends back into the first thing, which is, well, what is the substance of religion?
Yeah, no, and this is an approach that was created or thought of by my old teacher, Kent Greenewalt. He's got an article back in the 1980s, and his view was, look, what you're trying to do is you're trying to look at the various themes or strands that traditional or established religion has, and while you're not considering any one of those determinative, the more strands that a new phenomenon has, you know, the more religion-like it's going to be. In some ways, it kind of reminds me of the IRS
Yes.
approach, right? I mean, it's looking at like all of these sort of substantive qualities, and it's kind of making a, you know, holistic evaluation about whether a particular religious or a claimant with respect to religion has enough of these.
No, that's
to be
a nice
enough.
Point. That's a nice point, Mark. The IRS definition does seem like the analogical approach. And then finally is the most subjective of all of these. There's, you can say, well, the court will say, does the claimant sincerely hold certain beliefs, whether they're coherent or not? Just look at the sincerity of the person.
Right, right. I take it this is in some ways related to the functional, or it's perhaps a more extreme version of the functional definition. It doesn't matter if the beliefs are coherent. It doesn't matter if they match up with the religious faith tradition of which the claimant says he's a part. Nothing matters other than what basically the claimant says, provided it doesn't seem like the claimant is lying.
Right. So those are the four different approaches. Now, you might say, well, what's the payoff here? Why are the courts doing this? And I think there are some important themes in the cases and in the jurisprudence here, in leaving aside for a minute the black letter definitions. I mean, one thing we just talked about, one theme is sincerity. You know, does the claimant genuinely believe what he is saying, or does this just seem like a pretext? I'm reminded of the Seinfeld episode in which George Costanza goes around raising money for something called the Human Fund, which doesn't exist at all. He's just trying to get out of giving people Christmas gifts.
Right, and there have been these cases that people who are, especially those scholars who are very much opposed to religious accommodation, raise about people in prison who make up religions, you know, the religion of the new song, a church of the new song, so that they can get, you know, filet mignon and calvados
right.
Served to them every Friday or something like that, right? Those would be obviously, those are lies, right? You know, people who actually don't believe what they're saying, right. but they're doing so for some ulterior purpose.
And, you know, nobody would say that, you know, we should protect people who are being insincere about this, although courts are very reluctant as a practical matter to say anyone is being insincere because it's so hard really to know, and you want to be respectful of people's individual beliefs. Because after all, another big theme here is the respect for individual conscience. The state respects religion because religion is so important to individual integrity, personal dignity and individual integrity. And, you know, you don't want to force someone to go against his individual conscience. That's an important theme here.
Right. And so the line between a subjective understanding about what it is that I'm compelled to do and a fraud can be very difficult for courts as a practical matter to fish out. And so, again, as a practical matter, they're probably more inclined to err on the side of just sort of saying, well, you know, we're going to assume sincerity here.
Right. And then two other important themes in the cases are neutrality and equality. So neutrality as a factor just means that, and we should say, as we just were noting, the court doesn't always act this way, even though it says it's acting this way. The idea is that the state must be neutral with regard to the substance of religion. The state has no business adjudicating religious orthodoxy or making civil rights dependent on one's religious beliefs. It's a very Lockean notion which goes back right to the beginning.
Even more than that, not just neutral about religion, but neutral as between religion and non-religion. So there's a kind of Olympian neutrality that is the aspiration. And neutrality has really become perhaps the most important, the most unifying value in the court's jurisprudence on both the free exercise and the Establishment Clause side after the period of separationism started to wane. So neutrality has been the value that has kind of replaced separationism.
Right. And you might say neutrality and equality are kind of different ways of saying the same thing, because just as the state must be neutral with respect to the substance of beliefs, the state also has to be neutral with respect to how it treats different religious groups. That is to say, it has to treat them equally. Now, you said maybe even the state has to treat religion and non-religion equally. That's the theme in the cases, although it's a little more controversial in the cases. But, of course, equality, Mark, only attaches to like things, to things within the same category. So you'd have to decide whether something is, in fact, a religion before the duty would arise to treat it the same way you treat other religions.
So, right. No, I think that's right. And you might think about neutrality and equality kind of bound together in a general principle of non-discrimination, right? The idea of, you know, we have to treat everything the same, and we can't treat anything worse than anything else.
Right. Okay, so with all that as background, let's get to the question. Is the Satanic Temple a religion? Or we should say, was the IRS right to call it a religion? So look, there are some themes in the cases that suggest the temple is a religion. On a functional definition, for example, you know, non-theistic religions can qualify. Arguably, the commitments of the temple serve the function of a religion in the lives of the members of the temple.
They're obviously very important.
Very important to them. It's consistent. To call the temple a religion would be consistent with this subjective definition of religion. It's just whatever the person says it is. And there are some neutrality concerns that might argue in favor of that conclusion. But I think, Mark, there are real problems, too.
Well, there are problems. It's a question about whether the believers are sincere. You know, we've said that the group is a protest group. On the other hand, it does seem that they're sincere about what it is that they believe.
That's true.
It doesn't seem like they're lying about what they believe. This is, again, one of these problems about exactly what do they have to be sincere about. Do they have to have a sincere belief in the view that their views are religious? Well, then, you know, we're kind of making a circle, right? I mean, what we were trying to start out to decide in the beginning is whether they count as a religion. So it seems a little tautological to say, well, do they believe that they're a religion?
Well, right? because we're not willing to commit as a legal system to actually a strong definition of what the religion is. I mean, look, it's certainly not a traditional religion. If you take the Yoder test or the Reynolds test, this really wouldn't count as a religion. In fact, they're sort of the opposite of a traditional religion. Their raison d'etre is to mock traditional religion.
And even on the analogical definition of religion or approach to defining religion, as we've said, it doesn't seem, with respect to those 14 factors that the IRS lays out or to making analogies to traditional religions, that there are sufficient number of factors that would drive a court to say that it is religious.
Right. And so I have to say, to my mind, these problems indicate the temple shouldn't be understood as a religion for legal purposes, although I understand people could disagree about that given the vague nature of the law in this area.
Yeah, I think for me, what all of this points up to is the sort of pressure points within law and religion law that the Satanic Temple has able to very cleverly exploit. So you want to talk a little bit about those?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think particularly these themes about neutrality and equality. I mean, I think you're right. The temple has been very clever at exploiting these things. If the state must recognize as a religion on equal terms with other religions a group that defines itself essentially as an anti-religion, well, then what's left of the category of religion for legal purposes? I mean, conceptually.
And so one thing here is it really right to say that it's an anti-religion, or is it more precise to say that it's anti-particular traditional religions, especially Christianity?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Maybe.
Right? So, because again, we've been debating what it is that counts as a religion, because religion is a sort of a black box category, mm-hmm. right? So maybe the right thing to say is no, it's not anti-religion, because we can't agree about what counts as religion at all. Religion, on some accounts, is a kind of scholarly category that was created by people in the 19th century. No, it's anti-Christian, mm-hmm. or it's anti-Judeo-Christian, mm-hmm. or it's something like that, that would rope in specific religious traditions mm-hmm. to show what it's opposing.
Yeah, okay, it could be. I mean, maybe you'd say it's anti-Abrahamic religion, because I'm sure, I think Islam also has the concept of Satan, too. But look, I guess we'd say if a group like the Satanic Temple can qualify as a religion for legal purposes, then religion becomes sort of an empty category. And I wonder whether, in fact, it's a workable category for purposes of legal analysis if the Satanic Temple is correct that it's a religion just like all the others, which may be kind of what the Satanic Temple is trying to achieve here, to show this is an empty category and really doesn't deserve protection.
Well, and I think there is a certain logic to this. You know, why should religions get these special statuses, 501c3 status, the ability to make legislative prayers at town meetings, or receive accommodations from otherwise generally applicable laws? If you don't have a set of criteria for what's in and what's not in, then people are going to get upset. They're going to say, well, why am I being treated differently mm-hmm. than some other group or tradition on the basis of factors and criteria that you can't even articulate?
Right. Well, as I say, I think that is maybe the goal here. But if that's the case, then look, I mean, then we say that religion is simply not a protected category anymore, which I would not agree with, Mark. I don't think you would agree with that. So and that's why I say I think it's a very clever strategy by the temple.
Well, and the other thing is, we might think about it presses on the pressure point of neutrality.
Correct. Right?
Whether it really is true that any state can be truly neutral as between religion and non-religion, or as between religions, if you don't have any criteria for determining what's in and what's out.
Right.
Just doesn't seem to me to be possible to do that. And we have the other issue, of course, we've been coming back to it again and again. The Satanic Temple is reacting not against religion, but against particular religious traditions that have been vital, formative, for good or ill, with respect to the history and culture of the country. Primary among those is Christianity. So if you've got a society that is fundamentally shaped, at least as a historical matter, by Christianity, then it doesn't make any sense to really take a neutral point of view. Mm-hmm. If you say all religions are going to be the same, by definition, you are decreasing the importance and relevance of Christianity within that culture and increasing other things.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I'd go as far as that, but I do think, although I might, but I'm not sure. But I do think that the Satanic Temple, the example of the Satanic Temple, really does highlight some real tensions in our church and state law, specifically with respect to what is a religion that will be protected by the law. And I hope at least, listeners, we've convinced you of that. So with that, we're going to close this one. Again, this is Mark Movsesian and Mark DiGirolami for the Center of Law for Law and Religion at St. John's with another episode of Legal Spirits. You can find archived episodes at our website, lawandreligionforum.org, and also on Apple iTunes. See you next time.